The Sydney Sentinel would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather and pay our respects to their elders, past, present and emerging.
Welcome, everyone. You're listening to the Sentinel Speakeasy, the official podcast of the Sydney Sentinel, the independent voice of Sydney, located at sydneysentinel.com.au. It's episode 11 of season 3 of the Speakeasy. I'm features writer and podcast producer Travis DeJonk, and I'll be your host for the next half hour or so of news, current affairs, and discussion relating to Sydney. Our special guest on the show today is Tim Duggan, an extraordinary and adventurous Australian that isn't just a business powerhouse, but an expert in the art of creating social phenomenon, activation, and change. He's an optimist who firmly believes in the power of business to do good. And he leads by example, running some of this nation's most prominent and awarded media outlets and events. In 2020, he added award-winning author to his impressive career credits. His first book, Cult Status, How to Build a Business People Adore, was named Best Entrepreneurship and Small Business Book at the 2021 Australian Business Book Awards. And this May, Duggan releases his second book, Killer Thinking, an inspiring self-help business book that examines and inspires creativity in the workplace, helping to bring about positive solutions and change that the world needs right now. It's a bloody fantastic read. Now, Tim Duggan is currently the chairman of the Digital Publishers Alliance, on top of working with a range of businesses that he is passionate about. Our interview with this inspiring Australian is coming up later in the show. But as always, first up, here are the top stories you'll find at sydneysentinel.com.au. Inner West Council residents were shocked to be told by the Inner West Council's general manager that they were effectively being shut out of the preparation of the demerger case to the New South Wales local government minister. General Manager Peter Gainsford told the well-attended online meeting organised by the Residents for De-amalgamation on April 7th that he had commissioned Morrison Lowe to develop the business case for the demerger and that the public would get to see it after the council. Residents spent the whole of question time asking Gainsford about the secrecy surrounding the demerger process, including why it had not been put to tender, why councillors and residents had not been given an opportunity to comment on or even see the specifications, and why, given the 62.5% yes to the demerger vote at the council poll, residents were being effectively locked out of the process. Gainsford conceded that Inner West Council residents had shown keen interest in the demerger. He said the council had commissioned Morrison Lowe before and dismissed the concerns that the consultant's report would be skewed. Its previous cost-benefit report, touted as neutral, argued against de-amalgamation. Greens councillor Justine Langford told the meeting, "There has been no consultation with councillors or the community on how this very important project should be approached. There has been no tendering of the project to consultants and no consideration by councillors and the community on the terms of reference for the project." Associate Professor of Social Policy and Governance, Joseph Drew, who was invited to speak about whether de-amalgamations can work, said successful demergers have happened in Australia and that experts in local government, not financial consultants, should be involved in crafting demerger proposals. Drew said that New South Wales forced amalgamations started off badly and it's getting worse. It started off costing an extra 10% per unit cost and it has just gotten more inefficient. He reported that some amalgamated councils are under administration and others, such as Cootamundra Gundagai, have had to put up their rates 55.5% to keep their heads above water. He said the Inner West Council's best chance is a change in government and that it is worth noting that no one has gotten de-amalgamations by going through the New South Wales Boundaries Commission's process. Several residents, including former councillor and mayor Rochelle Porteous, call on the general manager to ensure residents and councillors are involved in preparing the demerger case. Now, you can read the full story at sydneysentinel.com.au. Despite the seismic changes that have convulsed media communications and journalism since the turn of the millennium, the mainstream media remains a formidably relevant force, including at election time. Data on where people get their news makes this clear. In 2021, about 61% of Australians accessed television news in an average week, and 47% used online news platforms. These are dominated by the established media organisations. The top 10 digital news titles over the 12 months to December 2021 were all mainstream media. At the top was news.com.au, followed by the ABC, 9.com.au, the Sydney Morning Herald, and 7 News. All except the Daily Mail, which lost ground heavily, showed year-on-year growth. While just 20% of people use print-based media, reflecting the decline of newspapers since the digital revolution really got going in 2006, the data from the Roy Morgan Research indicates the slide might be slowing, at least in some markets. The data is preliminary, but shows a quite remarkable 10.4% growth in the Australian's print audience, growth of 8.2% in the Daily Telegraph's, and 3.1% in the Sydney Morning Herald's. A striking feature of these figures is the growth in audience of News Corporation newspapers across the country, except in Melbourne. This raises interesting questions about the kinds of news Australians seem to want. For decades, surveys have shown Australian media consumers prize impartiality in news reporting very highly, rating it second only to accuracy as the attribute they value most in news content. A report for the Australian Communications and Media Authority in 2020 cited a Morgan survey from 2018 showing the attributes people considered most important when deciding which news media to trust. The top two were accuracy in reporting at 93% and impartiality at 90%. So is this changing? Is it possible people's extensive exposure to social media and the use of it as a source of news is altering their taste in news and the assessment of which attributes matter? After all, at 52%, social media is now the second most accessed source of news for Australians, not far behind the 61% for television. Or could it be that in an age of intense political polarisation, people prefer news that promotes the perspectives of their tribe at the expense of impartiality? Social media news content, much of which comes nowhere near meeting journalistic standards of impartiality, unquestionably provides this, creating a well-established phenomenon of filter bubbles and echo chambers. At the same time, the feedstock for social media news content is to a significant extent drawn from mainstream media. This is especially so in an election campaign, where the media pack travelling with each of the main party's leaders is comprised of mainstream media. It is they who are given the accreditation and direct access to the leaders. Social media takes this raw material and gives it various treatments, memes, altered context, and distortions of multiple kinds to entertain, enrage, or mobilise. In this way, mainstream news influences what goes on in social media, adding to the mainstream media's reach and relevance, yet along the way, commonly losing the attributes of accuracy and impartiality that people say they value. Contradictions abound. There's a lot more to this fascinating and topical feature, and you can read the full article at sydneysentinel.com.au. One of the saddest experiences in life is losing a loved one, family, friends, or even pets. While some might find it uncomfortable to speak about matters relating to death, others say the conversation needs to be had. The team from the Groundswell Project Australia is a good example of those calling for such conversations. The group, which aims to improve how individuals, organisations, and communities die, care, and grieve, is encouraging Australians to get used to talking about death and dying, calling on citizens to get dead set during their annual Dying to Know campaign. The nationwide campaign is urging people of various ages and stages of life to cultivate knowledge and compassion about end-of-life matters, a topic experts say has been brought into high relief by the COVID-19 pandemic. Recent research conducted by Liz Loeb, adjunct professor at palliative care at the University of Technology Sydney and the University of Notre Dame, suggests that people are experiencing grief more strongly now than before the pandemic. The Dying to Know campaign aims to help bridge the gap by providing death literacy, which helps people gain the knowledge, compassion, and practical skills needed to support and assist others in end-of-life choices. While businesses such as funeral homes offer support in the immediate aftermath of a death, the Dying to Know campaign aims to help Australians be prepared for death ahead of time by encouraging people to create a will and have conversations about death with loved ones so that their wishes are known in advance, ensuring appropriate care, end-of-life decisions, and funerals. With the Voluntary Assisted Dying Bill 2021 passing in the lower house of the New South Wales Parliament late last year, discussions of end-of-life matters has gained traction in recent months, something the Dying to Know campaign manager Sherelle Martin has welcomed. The Dying to Know campaign culminates in Dying to Know Day, which is held on the 8th of August. Now, for more information, visit www.dyingtoknowday.com. People are also encouraged to join the conversation and share their experiences via social media using the hashtags #GetDeadSet and #DyingToKnowDay. For more information on this, visit sydneysentinel.com.au. Those are just some of the top news headlines at the Sydney Sentinel. In addition to those news items, there are a bevy of fantastic arts and entertainment features that are definitely worth checking out, including features on iconic 80s pop music producers Stock H. Waterman, interviews with Hamilton the musical star Lyndon Watts, and Aussie comedian Sammy J, and a whole lot more. Remember, for more news, as well as a huge range of arts and entertainment content, feature articles, news, opinion, and queer, vegan, and news content, visit sydneysentinel.com.au. You can also find us on Facebook at The Sydney Sentinel and on Instagram and Twitter, where our handle is Sydney_Sentinel. And while on the subject of our social media, there have been some sensational events happening in Sydney over the past recent weeks, and the Sentinel has had our talented photographer Anne-Marie Callahan there to capture all the personalities and colour of these events, which you will find on our social media photo galleries on Facebook and Instagram. Such great images. You really got to check them out, so please do. And now it is time for our special guest interview. Now, In the Mix, Faster Louder, samesame.com.au, Fag Tag, Nevermind Nightclub, Junkie Media. At least some of these incredible Aussie media outlets and events will be familiar to you. And all of them were created, at least in part, by our guest on the show today. Tim Duggan is an extraordinary and adventurous Australian, not just a business powerhouse, but an expert in the art of creating social phenomenon, activation, and change. He's a genuine optimist who firmly believes in the power of business to do good, and he's leading by example. Now, Tim Duggan began his career as a music journalist for Rolling Stone and went on to co-found several digital media ventures, most notably Junkie Media, the leading digital publisher for young Australians, which was acquired by ASX-listed oMedia. In 2018, industry organisation Mumbrella named Junkie Media the Large Publication Company of the Year, and they're the only company to be awarded Mumbrella's coveted Media Brand of the Year for multiple titles, Junkie and Punky. And in 2020, he added award-winning author to his impressive career credits. His first book, Cult Status, How to Build a Business People Adore, was named the Best Entrepreneurship and Small Business Book at the 2021 Australian Business Book Awards. And this May, Duggan releases his second book, Killer Thinking, an inspiring self-help business book that examines and inspires creativity in the workplace. It's a bloody fantastic read. Tim Duggan lives with his husband Ben and dog Winnie in Sydney, where he is currently the chairman of the Digital Publishers Alliance, a group representing over 100 titles from the leading independent publishers in the country, as well as working with a range of businesses that he is passionate about. To talk about that, his exciting book, Killer Thinking, and a whole lot more, he joined me in the studio earlier. Let's have a listen to that interview now. Tim Duggan, such a pleasure. Thank you for joining us on the Sentinel Speakeasy. How are you, mate?
I'm great, Trav. Thank you for having me.
Well, there's a lot to talk about. So firstly, for any of our listeners who are not familiar with you and the incredible work you've done over like really two decades, you were just in your like mid-20s when you were already hitting some pretty impressive home runs. Can you give us a bit of a background to how you started out? Just tell us a bit about your background.
Yeah, so I started out originally in advertising agencies when I was straight out of school. I went into the mail room of an ad agency, which I don't even know if mail rooms exist anymore, but I was a kid. I would get mail and I'd hand it out to people. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a very strange job, but it was a wonderful exposure into the world of advertising and marketing. Mm-hmm. And from there, I realized that I liked advertising and marketing, but I didn't love it. Mm-hmm. And instead, on the side, I started to write for magazines that I really loved. So I started writing for Rolling Stone when I was very young, 19 or 20 years old. Yeah, I watched the movie Almost Famous, and
that makes so much sense.
Yeah. And so I fell into writing, and I just loved the act of taking all the jumbled thoughts inside my head and trying to rearrange them onto a piece of paper. Mm-hmm. Travis, you would understand the satisfaction mm-hmm. that comes from that.
Yeah, indeed. And the challenge as well. Like it's not always an easy thing to do, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And at the same time, I'd come out as gay when I was about 19 or 20. Mm-hmm. And I saw a gap in the market for events that were kind of built for this kind of new generation coming through at the time. And then this was almost 20 years ago. Mm. And it was about, I started this event series when I was 22 or 23 called Fag Tag. And Fag Tag was all about venturing out of the well-worn paths and taking over a venue or tagging it, a traditionally straight venue. And it grew in popularity very quickly, so much so that within the first few months of launching it, I would have this email list. I'd tell people where to turn up. And up to 1,000 people would turn up at these events. And so that became this just really interesting side hustle. And it led me to then launch my first community website called Same Same in 2006. Mm-hmm. And Travis, you were involved with Same Same. I've known you for a very long time.
I was, full disclosure. We have worked together before. And it was at a time where you were the co-founder of samesame.com.au, which was Australia's largest gay and lesbian news site and community. And I think it's really important distinction, I think, between a lot of the other media that was around. It was definitely a genuine online community. And it's something of the likes that I have not seen before or since. So a very interesting place to work.
It really was. And it was amazing being at the helm of this community. Like you could feel the power that came. And this was relatively early days of the internet. Facebook and, wasn't even in Australia for a couple of years until after we launched Same Same. Social media didn't have the dominance that it has now. Mm. And there was this burgeoning need for people to meet each other and to connect online. And so we had forums on Same Same where tens of thousands of people came to every month to post comments, as you would know, Trav. I think we've probably spent a lot of time in the forums.
Yes. Yeah, moderating. Same Same was also part of this thing called the Sound Alliance, right? There was a whole heap of websites that were kind of related to music, different genres of music, and you were really kind of trying to create something. Like, what was your role within that bigger machine?
Yeah, so Sound Alliance was originally started by three of my friends, Neil, Libby, and Andre, and they'd started a music website called In The Mix. Yeah. And In The Mix was a electronic music website, dance music website, that really pioneered community building in Australia. Mm. So, Same Same had tens of thousands of people. Mm. In The Mix had hundreds of thousands of people.
Wow.
I saw what they were doing, and it really excited me. It mm-hmm. felt like it was new, uncharted territory. Mm. And so I co-founded Same Same with the three of them.
Yep.
And then I got introduced to this whole bigger, wider world out there, which was In The Mix was dance music. There's another website called Faster Louder, which was live music.
Yeah.
There was an Australian music website called Mess and Noise. Mm-hmm. And it was these real amazing passion points that were creating a community home for anyone who is interested in those passion points to come together and to meet and to talk. For me, it was this amazing learning launch pad around how to build community and how to get people together and all singing from a similar song sheet.
Yeah, a very interesting moment in Australian media history. And I think when we look back, I think people will really get a sense of that. The things you were able to achieve, as part of that organisation is pretty extraordinary. Aside from just having this incredible contact with, particular demographic, I would say like the youth demographic in Australia was like tremendous. My question following that is, what did that kind of interaction with the youth of, aging in anywhere between 12 and 36, what sort of insights did that give you into the kind of place that Australia is?
Yes, so many insights. And there's a couple of thoughts around this.
Mm.
The first one was that when we originally started working with these websites, we were youths ourselves.
Yeah.
So originally, a bunch of these websites were aimed at 18 to 24-year-olds when we were 18 to 24. And then it got expanded to 18 to 29-year-olds and then 18 to 35-year-olds and then 18 to 40-year-olds. And so we kind of grew up as business people alongside the audience.
Mm.
A few years in, a couple of years before we launched Junkie, which was the pop culture title that we launched in 2013, realized that we needed to understand the audience better than we did.
Yeah.
So the audience was changing. So over those years, people grew up. So this is from 2000s through to now. The entire world around us changed at an unprecedented rate. Mm. So there was technology change, there was society change, there was political change. And in particular, around 2012, we noticed that young people were becoming a lot more engaged with politics than they had been in the past.
Mm-hmm.
So up until that point, I think even Howard was in for, you know, most people's younger lives.
Yeah.
There was a relative stability. There was a relative apathy. People weren't that engaged. And around 2012, 2013, we started to notice that was changing. We did a bunch of research. We've done one of the largest longitudinal studies of Australian youth. We've spoken to about 25, 30,000 people over 10 years.
Incredible. Wow.
And we started that in about 2011, 2012. And that's when we noticed that young people in particular were becoming more engaged with the news. So we launched a website called Junkie, which was meant to be just one of the websites that we had. We had about five or six different websites, and Junkie was just another one.
Yeah.
And within 6 months, a couple of things happened.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, Tony Abbott got voted into power, which really riled up a lot of young people because he was the antithesis of what they stood for.
Yeah.
And secondly, we kind of discovered that there was this need and desire to break down news and politics and do it in a really interesting way that young people could understand. Yeah. And that really hadn't been done before. And we had the additional rising tide of Facebook at that time was growing massively.
Yeah.
And you could build really big brands on social media.
Yeah.
So in a period of a couple of years, BuzzFeed launched in the US, Vice really took off, Vox Media launched in the US, Junkie launched in Australia, Pedestrian started doing news writing after we did it, you know, in terms of politics and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And you just had this explosion in awareness, and we were just in right place, right time to take advantage of that.
Yeah, you did end up becoming like probably the most recognised media company in Australia, and awards left, right and centre, right? It was coming out the wazoo.
it was an amazingly heady and exciting time, so much so that then Junkie, two of the original founders of Sound Alliance left the business, and we rebranded and kind of rejigged the entire business into Junkie Media. And Neil Ackland, my business partner, and I kind of led that for the last decade after that.
Yeah, incredible. Are you still involved? Are you still involved in running Junkie, or is that, are you onto new pastures now? Are you just riding full time?
So I left Junkie full time in October 2020, and I jumped into originally meant to move overseas with my husband, and we'll get to this in a second.
Yeah, great.
So I left Junkie full time in October 2020, and I moved into a role as editor at large. Kind of an advisory title. Junkie has now moved on to a new exciting home. A new company bought Junkie recently. And I'm still involved in some ways with kind of making sure that, you know, my baby is still, you know, thriving and doing stuff. But there's an amazing team in place over there. A lot of them who have been there for, you know, since I was there. And then a bunch of new exciting staff. So I'm now watch Junkie from afar and watch it with pride.
That's fantastic. Just like a parent, you know, you watch a child grow up and then you let them go and they're doing their own thing.
Yes, that's exactly it.
That's beautiful. Now, the reason why I'm asking you all of these questions, of course, is because you've authored two incredible books, and it's just giving our listeners a bit of a sense of things that you've done, and they're quite important. The other things, too, before we go on to discussing the book and your writing, is in the time that I've known you, you're one of the most interesting and original people I've ever met in my life, you know, and in as far as not just are you thinking originally in terms of business, but even in your own life is a reflection of that. I mean, ever since I've known you, I think you were one of the first people I ever knew who went to the Burning Man Festival in the United States, which is like the biggest festival of radical expression in the world. You went to the base camp of Mount Everest. I mean, this is stuff you were doing in your mid to late 20s. And I just remember thinking, who is this guy? He's incredible. So when I found out that you were writing when you're writing a book, and especially a book about business, which I'm going to be honest, not my favorite genre, right? I usually find that whole kind of capitalistic kind of, you know, promises of financial wealth and kind of production without thought. That's the stuff that puts me off those kinds of books. But you really do something very different with your books. What were you looking for when you went on those adventures? Like, what was it you were hoping to discover, or that you were hope to get out of them?
Thank you very much, first of all, for those very kind words, Travis. It has life so far has been a real journey, and I have tried to live it to the fullest. That's kind of like my simple mentality. So things like Burning Man, which I went to for the first time in 2011 and then returned a couple of years later, and, you know, really inspired me to live a more creative and interesting life. And there was a moment when I would try to do something every year that scared me. So, you know, going to Burning Man without knowing too much about it, that scared me because it had a lot of myth around it back then, as it still does. Going to Everest Base Camp was something that really scared me as well because it's, you know, it's quite a challenge, and it was
daunting, right? It's a huge undertaking.
And it was quite physically daunting, but amazingly satisfying. And if, in fact, you can actually draw a direct line from doing some of those, you know, more physical kind of fun things to writing my first book, because I had always enjoyed writing, but the business got bigger. And before I knew it, I was managing teams of people who did the writing, and I was helping to kind of craft where they were going, but I hadn't picked up a pen in almost a decade. So for me, it was daunting to kind of think, okay, can I still do this? Am I any good at this? And so my first book, Cult Status, I wrote whilst I was still working full-time at Junkie. And I got up at 4 something in the morning for about a year or two to write little bits every single day. And that, to me, that was my own personal Everest Base Camp, because it was this big, daunting thing that I didn't know if I was going to be able to do. But I just put one foot in front of each other as I went along. And, you know, I think I even wrote in the book something around the proverb around how do you eat an elephant? One mouthful.
Yes, that's right.
And so that's kind of how I approached writing the first book, Cult Status. And that came out in 2020. And, you know, when you put anything creative out into the world, you never know how it's going to be received. And I have the utmost respect for anybody who puts things out into the world and says, judge me. And that is any artist, any musician, even any business person who puts a business idea out there and says, this is what I think. It's daunting and it's scary.
You did an exceptional job with it. I mean, so firstly, like you say, kudos to those people who can stand up and sing or speak in public or write a book. I mean, it's really, there's nowhere to hide when you're putting yourself out there like that. But more than that, like, I mean, I think because the bigger picture of who you are and the things that you've done, I was very excited about reading that book. The first thing I did, I went out and I picked it up, and because I thought if I was going to take advice from anybody, I thought it's going to be from this guy who thinks differently and I knew would be informed by a different way of thinking and just had already done some really amazing things. Now, Cult Status was it was a fantastic book. It was a kind of a 7-step program in terms of how you take something from idea into not just a business, but a concept that the world would embrace, right? And the difference between a lot of other business books and what you'd written was that for the first time I felt that there was a sense of purpose. You know, why do we do the things we do? There's got to be a purpose behind it. It's not just, you know, we make vitamins or we make, you know, solutions for businesses. It's like, what is the impact and what is the purpose? So that's why it's an incredible book. Now you've come up with your second book, which is called Killer Thinking. And I was just curious to get your opinion on what does Killer Thinking do that you didn't get across in Cult Status?
Yeah, and the way that I describe my books is like business self-help books. And I say that because I have read almost every business book that's out there. But, you know, it's probably a slight exaggeration, but certainly the
lead. A lot of,
And so many of them are focused on profit first and big American companies and here's some examples of things that are so unattainable to you that will make you feel insignificant because you're insignificant. Or maybe that's just me when I read some of the books. I often didn't feel inspired after reading them because they didn't reflect me and who I am. And so I write these books for myself. That's the simplest answer is I think that there is an audience there, and cult status has proven that.
Yeah.
For books that look more holistically at business.
Yeah.
So they look at how a business sits within the world and how it impacts everything around it, not just the product that it makes, but how it makes the product. And so with cult status, it was amazing to be able to, at the time, pre-COVID, fly around the world and chat with business people that I thought were doing, were building really amazing businesses, and then distill all of that down into seven steps to building a business that people adore.
Mm-hmm.
And with Killer Thinking, it exists in the same world as cult status. That's kind of like one way that I use to describe it.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes a bit further.
Mm.
So cult status is, if you want to start a business, here's how to do it. Or if you have thoughts about it, it's one way of doing it. Whereas Killer Thinking is about broadening that out to be more accessible to people who might be thinking, yes, you can apply this to business. So it could be used at the start of coming up with a business idea, but can also, all of the methodologies in there can be applied to anything in your life.
Yeah.
And that is kind of the nucleus of how I started thinking about it.
That makes a lot of sense, actually. And I really, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that was really the feeling I got from it. I mean, when I first read Cult Status, there's a lot of detail in there. It's a bit more of a detailed book, a bit more businessy. The thing I love about Killer Thinking is that it is so incredibly accessible, and it relates so much more. It's just as much about you or the person reading it as it is about business ideas and ideas themselves. That's very exciting about it. The other thing I love too is that in both books, and this is one of the things I really love about your books, is that there's quite a different focus. There's that sense of purpose, change and solutions, but also inspiring case studies. They're like my favorite things to read. So many businesses that I didn't know were Australian. Like, they were just so good. There were ideas that were, at the time just gaining momentum, but now quite well established, that I had no idea what Aussie businesses. I'm thinking like Nexpa and who else?
GoTo. Zero Co. Obviously, Canva is in there. Linktree.
Yeah.
Movember.
Absolutely. And now these things are just like, they're such a part of, they're part of our language and our culture and our everyday lives. We use them. Very exciting ideas. It made me proud to be Aussie, which is always a good thing. Now, in between writing Cult Status and Killer Thinking, you embarked on a mammoth journey around Australia. Can you tell us a bit about that? Like, was that part of looking at more Aussie businesses, or what inspired you to do that?
It was not part of any plan. So I had a plan, and my plan was get married to my husband of 8 years, Ben.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. And we got married on the 14th of March, 2020. And if you go back to those days, you'll actually find that weddings got cancelled on the 15th of March, 2020.
Mm.
That was the week that the world fell apart.
Yeah.
So every single body fell apart in that week. And we had a wedding for 120 guests, including a lot of Scottish people, because my husband is Scottish,
right,
who had flown in from all around the world in country New South Wales. So it was quite a memorable time, but also so grateful to be able to squeeze in a wedding before the world changed.
Yeah.
And the plan then was to finish up full-time at Junkee and to move to Europe for a period of 18 months to 2 years to be closer to my husband's family for a time.
Right.
So we had everything sorted. We had the UK partner visa, we had flights, we had accommodation, we had a honeymoon, all that stuff booked.
Yeah.
That all turned to shit when COVID happened. And like everyone in the world, everyone's plans got stuffed up. So this is not a personal story.
Yeah.
And so instead, I tried to figure out, I'd been working at Junkee for 15 years and I knew that it was time to finish up and to hand the reins over to someone else.
Yeah.
And I wanted to do something that would be a full stop on my time. So it's something that allowed me to creatively stop my mind working so over time and just calm everything down. And we looked around and tried to figure out what we could do. And at the time, all the borders, the state borders, were shut everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we decided, let's jump into a camper van. Now, I had never been in a camper van outside of Burning Man.
Yeah, right.
You know? So I'd never, we're not camper people, you know, but we said, let's jump into a camper van and let's explore New South Wales, which is the state that we're in, for 6 weeks until the borders open and we can go back over to the UK.
Yeah.
We jumped into a camper van for 6 weeks around New South Wales and we had the best time. It was just this freedom of driving and exploring, and we knew how privileged we were to be able to do this during COVID. And what happened during that period was that slowly some of the other states started to open up. So when we got to the end of our 6 weeks, we were in Broken Hill and near the Mildura Victoria border, and Victoria opened up, and so we decided, let's just keep going. So we drove into Victoria. And then we came back to Sydney for Christmas, and then we said, let's just keep going. So we flew up to the Northern Territory, spent a couple of weeks up there, flew across to Perth, and then hired a new camper van in Perth and spent about 3 to 4 months going up and down the coastline over there.
Yeah, wow.
So all up, it was about 6 months in a camper van, and it was just the most glorious time.
What a great way to learn a bit about your nation. You know, it is a huge country with so many stories, and I can't even imagine what it must have been like.
It really was. It was the best place on earth to be locked down, because we have such a big, beautiful country. We had to navigate around opening and closing borders.
Yeah.
But we just got to explore so much of the beauty. And interestingly, I wrote most of Killer Thinking in the back of that camper van over that kind of 6 month period. So we would drive somewhere, we would park up the camper van, and I would get out my computer and just start writing and thinking about, you know, very lucky to be thinking about creativity whilst in such beautiful locations.
Yeah, and with your partner too. I mean, like, in terms of, we're speaking about game changers, Ben in your life definitely qualifies as that. Like, so you're not just married to each other, but you also adventure together and inspire each other. How has he influenced your process and perspective?
Ben has been one of the biggest influences on my life since I met him 8 years ago. Ben loves adventure and loves pulling me out of any well-worn rut that I might get into.
Fantastic.
So he just constantly is, you know, let's travel here, let's do this on the weekend, let's go out here to do this amazing restaurant. And we're just constantly, and that then inspires me to really use the most of every waking minute that we have. So whether it's night times, whether it's weekends, and, you know, there's times when I'm like, okay, slow down. I just want to sit on the couch and do nothing. And then anytime I, you know, get up and we do something exciting that is either inspired by Ben or he brings it out in me, I've never regretted it. Not once, not one dip in the ocean, not one amazing restaurant with an interesting cuisine that we've never tried, or not one holiday that we've gone on. So Ben has just really brings out the best of my adventure side.
That's beautiful. Isn't that like the goal of really like a relationship? That's a lovely thing. It should just bring more into your world. That's a lovely story, Tim. From Game Changers to Killer Thinking, it's one of the things I really love about this book, because I was really curious to see what more could you tell us? And reading it even more so than Cult Status, I really found myself reading this book. It's so incredibly accessible and breaks ideas down into, it's not businessy, it really breaks it down into, how does this relate to me and the world that I live in? I got so much out of it, and it's got me thinking, now everything that I do, I'm like, how can I apply this to, how can I make my daily actions more purposeful? That's a really big question, you know, and it's actually kind of, I'm already seeing little improvements in my daily life. Like, I'm just getting things together. It's such a helpful book in that way. What do you hope people are going to get out of it?
I love hearing that, Travis, because that is my intention with this book.
Right.
So my aim in life is to help people come up with better, more creative, more interesting, more impactful ideas. And whether that's in business or whether that's a creative idea or in your personal life. And so there's a really simple framework in the book where KILLER stands for kind, impactful, loved, lasting, easy, and repeatable.
Yeah.
And it's this framework that I have been thinking about for a long time. And then as soon as it kind of really clicked inside my head, is something that I also notice everywhere now.
Yeah.
So I will think of something and I'll be like, oh, how can I make that more kind? How can I make that more repeatable? How do I make this easier?
Mm.
And it's a really simple framework that I know that if it's helping me and helping the 1,000 ideas that I come up with every day, that my aim is just that it helps other people to also be able to use this in their everyday life.
What trends do you see happening in our society? Like, we're about to go into an election. It's really interesting looking at the different election ideas or you know, maybe at the lack of freshness in the ideas being pitched to Australian voters. And I'm just curious, what do you see as being the trends for the next 5 years in terms of like where will Aussie businesses be going, or what direction do you see successful businesses going? Like, who's going to succeed?
Yeah, there's a real change happening at the moment. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I have been thinking about for a long time. I've been watching it happen. And that change is built by the dominance of millennials coming up into the world, and not just millennials. It's more that the millennials are kind of at the forefront of this.
Yeah.
Because most people, and you know, I'm 41, I call myself the world's oldest living millennial.
I love that. That's great.
Yes, and I will till the day I die. And there's this just new way of thinking about businesses, new way of thinking about politics, that we're demanding more. So we're demanding that businesses and politicians and anyone in positions of power, bosses, really take into consideration how their actions affect other people besides themselves.
Mm.
So don't just think about how can something make me money. Think about what's the impact of this if I do it? What's the effect of this on the environment? What's the effect of this on the supply chain?
Yeah.
How does this affect the world around me, my employees, my colleagues? Mm. And this is this mega trend that is sweeping through, and the reason why a bunch of the businesses that I spoke to a few years ago for cult status genuinely have cult status and genuinely have power, and that's only going to grow. And I think if anyone reads Killer Thinking, it might just give them the tools or give them the ability to be able to tweak their ideas to give them the best chance of becoming a really killer idea that has lasting potential and has a potential for a really big impact.
That's fantastic. And I'll tell you what else has a really big potential for impact, and that is your new book, Killer Thinking, which comes out on the 3rd of May. I can't recommend it to our listeners enough. It really is one of those books that, like, you will read it and you will get so much out of it on a personal level. It's not about, do you want to run a business? It's like anything that you do in life, it is going to make you really more considered and thoughtful and purposeful in everything that you do. And it's a very valuable read. It comes out on the 3rd of May, 2022. So look out for it. Details on that will be in our podcast notes. Tim Duggan, such a pleasure. Always lovely to speak to you, but such a pleasure to have you on the Sentinel Speakeasy.
Thank you, Travis. Lovely to speak to you. Thanks for having me on.
And that was the inspiring Tim Duggan. His 2020 book, Cult Status, is available now, and his latest book, Killer Thinking, gets released on the 3rd of May 2022. Both books are published through Pantera Press. If you'd like to find out more about Tim Duggan or his fantastic books, you'll find the links in our podcast notes. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode. New episodes of the Sentinel Speakeasy go to air every Tuesday from 5 p.m. and you can tune in on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Buzzsprout, or wherever you get your podcasts. And remember, for more news, as well as a huge range of arts and entertainment content, feature articles, interviews, opinion, and queer, vegan, and youth content, visit sydneysentinel.com.au. You can find us on Facebook at The Sydney Sentinel and on Instagram and Twitter, where our handle is Sydney_Sentinel. Thanks so much to Tim Duggan for his time. And thanks so much to you, our readers and listeners, for joining us. I'll catch you next week. Bye for now.